Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show.
Co-host this week is our writer of the X button at the end at Anime News Network. It's Todd Siola. Hey, Todd.
Hey.
And our very special guest this week, we've got a little bit of a special show this time. Joining us from the president of Gaijin Works, formerly of Working Designs, kind of a legend in the JRPG community, it's Victor Ireland.
Hey, hello.
Thank you very much for coming on the show.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Also joining us is the president of Monkey Paw Games. It's John Grainer. John, thanks for coming on.
Sure, thank you.
And also the marketing manager from Monkey Paw Games, Ray Alameda.
Good to be here, guys.
Thanks. It's great to have all of you. So obviously, you know, we're an anime site. You guys work with Japanese video games. The two are so intertwined at this point that there's hardly any daylight between them. The fan bases are basically the same. And to that, you know, obviously our first question is for Victor. Like, how did you get your start? Because you are kind of a legend in the field. When did you first get started with Japanese role-playing games? When did they first, like, catch your eye?
Probably around somewhere between the Nintendo, the original NES, and the TurboGrafx. And basically, I was just really into the whole import scene. And it just, once I realized there was a whole another world outside of what we saw in the U.S., it just kind of blew my mind, and I became like a big kind of import guy. And I kind of became a bit of an expert in my circles of those kind of games because a lot of people just weren't aware the stuff was out there. And so I went from being sort of a rabid fan to kind of in the industry when I ended up writing about those games for like Turbo Play and stuff as a sort of an editorial capacity to actually publishing games, starting with Taito with Parasol Stars and Kadash. Kadash was really the one we wanted, and Parasol Stars was kind of like the one we lumped in with it. Mm-hmm. But you sort of transition from fan to kind of fan editorial guy to publisher, and then into straight out, you know, doing the TurboGrafx CD RPGs and stuff that really kind of amped things up.
Well, and like specifically, it was the role playing games that really drew your attention, because I mean, there's a tremendous amount of games from Japan back then that didn't even see the light of day here.
Yeah, my initial sort of interest was just in the kind of crazy Japanese games, because I mean, when I first got into games at, you know, that age, I don't know, maybe it was in my teens, I wasn't really aware that there was this whole other world that we never even saw. These games just never came out in the U.S. So initially, it was just kind of the wacky Japanese games, and then as I got more into it, the genre that really drew me in was the RPGs. And I don't know if I'm a masochist, and it was because I couldn't read anything, and I wanted to, you know, solve these games at any cost, even though they were 100 times more difficult when you couldn't understand what was going on. But, you know, that's the genre that drew me, and that's kind of where I really sort of laid down my stake is, you know, I really love these games, and I want more people to experience them as well.
And what was it like dealing with the Japanese back then? I mean, how did you even approach that subject? How did you even get in touch with any of those people to get your start in publishing?
Completely naively, and it would never work today because the market's just so much different. But I was just finding out where these companies were. I would get their contact information. And I don't even think that I got it from the internet. I think that I was getting it like from like the back of boxes and ads and things. And then I would just fax them. Just cold fax. I was cold faxing all these companies that I really admired and sort of, you know, being this ultimate otaku nerdy weirdo fan and, you know, talking about that. And then I would sort of whoever gave me a response, I would sort of latch onto that and just really start, you know, bombarding them, trying to get something happening. And it helped when I went from crazy fan to kind of semi-editorial guy. It helped because I was able to get a lot more contacts in an editorial capacity about games that I was going to talk about in Japan. So a lot of these companies that were like, whoa, that guy's weird, were more willing to talk to me when I could say, hey, I'm writing this article about these great games that haven't come over. And they're like, yeah, of course we'll talk to you. So that helped a lot. And so that transition from weirdo fan guy to editorial guy helped make the transition to publisher guy.
Wow. Okay. I mean, so, was anime at all a part of it for you back then, or were you just into games?
No, the anime was a huge part of it because the games that I liked the most, when you get to TurboGrafx, the games I liked the most were the fact that they had these CD intermissions with the anime stuff. You know, Ease was huge. You know, that kind of stuff where you'd have these animations that would pop up in the middle of gameplay. It was like, oh my God, you know, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like this. And so, anime was a huge part of it because, like I say, sort of the strangeness of the Japanese games is what kind of got me started at the very beginning. But what really drew me was those anime scenes and RPGs that would come up, you know, 3x3 Eyes and Tenchi no Uta and Cosmic Fantasy and, you know, all those games. Anime was a huge part of it.
Wow.
Now, it was actually Lunar, I think, that most people think of when they remember working designs. And that came along after you'd left the TurboGrafx and gone to the Sega CD.
Yes.
And can you tell us how that came about? Because that was really the big game for working designs back in.
Yeah, that was – well, Lunar, I mean, you know, going backwards, we picked up a lot of fans. Lunar on the PlayStation, you know, really expanded our fan base. We sold like almost 500,000 copies between Lunar 1 and 2 just on the PlayStation, which was probably – let's see, it would be about 5 times more or almost 7 times more than we did on the Sega CD, because Sega CD was such a limited platform. But the Sega CD one, I mean, we already had a sort of track record with the TurboGrafx, and we were, you know, moving over to the Sega CD because it was pretty clear that TurboGrafx was just, you know, on a downward trajectory, and we have sort of a habit of going down with the platform ship. You know, we'll be like the last publisher on that platform. But we saw where it was going, and we were making that transition to the Sega CD, and I loved Lunar. I had no idea what it was when I first heard about it, but then once I got the import, I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Why has nobody done this? Why haven't anybody, you know, called these guys and tried to do this game? So I couldn't understand why it wasn't being done, because it was clearly head and shoulders above anything that had been done up to that point. And so, again, I went back to my nerdy fanboy guy and cold called the Japanese company, and, you know, call them, you know, Ego Hanashimasu, you know, anybody speak English, you know, give me some English. And eventually got in touch with the assistant to the president, and then went back and forth with facts, you know, asking to do the title and trying to convince him to do it. And, you know, he politely declined the first time, he politely declined the second time, and then the third time I found out later that, you know, he said the reason he agreed to meet was because he's like, who is this guy? He will not give up. And that was my thing. I mean, I was like, you can decline, but tell me why you're declining and we'll work it out. We'll figure out a way over it, you know, because this has to come out. And that kind of charmed him, I guess, in that he was like, you know, I've got to meet this guy because he just does not give up. And I wasn't going to, because like I say, the game was amazing. It had to be seen. And I don't think Miyagi, the president of Game Arts at the time, I don't think he trusted anybody else to do it well. And then once he met and kind of saw how, you know, I was frothing at the mouth, how crazy I kind of was and how into the project I was, that sort of fear was allayed. And he's like, okay, this guy can probably make a good go of it. And, you know, we did a great job with that, I think.
Okay, yeah. And then from the Sega CD, you went on to the Saturn. And that, like you said, you had the last game on the Sega Saturn. That was Magic Knight Ray Earth, which was delayed for a number of years.
Yes. Well, yeah, and the crazy thing is the last long delay on that, you know, the last, I don't know, it was like 4 to 6 months, mm-hmm. was them at the last minute trying to get us to change the character names to match the U.S. crappy anime names.
Right, because they were planning to do this version of Ray Earth for the U.S. and change all the names. I don't think it ever actually came out.
Yeah, well I didn't know that it didn't come out, because we had the video of what they were changing it to, and this was like an 11th hour thing. I mean, the game was done pretty much. It was recorded pretty much. You know, we would have had a huge amount of work to change it to match these names, and the names they had were horrible.
Yeah, like Undine or something, or
an enemy. They were wow. they were like sea things, like Foo was an enemy, and yeah, it's a sea creature, but when you're saying it sounds like you're saying an enemy. It was awful. In a game, it would have been terrible. And I think in an anime, it would have been awful too. But anyway, so they were trying to get changed at the last minute. So like the last, I don't remember exactly, but it was like 6 months or so was us going back and forth saying, look, we can't do this. This is awful. These names are terrible. It's a huge amount of work. Why didn't you tell us this 2 years ago? You know, it was one of the, you know, sort of the last, you know, awful thing we had to go through on that project. Because the project was terrible from the beginning. I mean, the game was great, and that's why we went through all the pain. But, you know, the source code was pieces that were lost. Chunks of the data was gone. We had to reconstruct stuff. I mean, it was a nightmare project.
And this was, of course, Sega was planning to do this version of Ray Earth in the U.S. Or was it the parent company or something like that?
No. Clamp, the people that made the Ray Earth anime.
Right.
They had done some deal to do a U.S. anime. It wasn't through Sega. It was through somebody else. But we had a sort of a test reel or something showing the changes, and we were just like, mouths agape, like, oh my god, what the heck is this? And how much work is this going to be to do? Basically, it was like, what they're asking is impossible at this point. We can't do it. So we had to fight for, you know, it was like 4 to 6 months to say, look, we've got to just release it as is. This is the deal we had. This deal we signed. There was nothing about changing names when we signed this deal years ago. And eventually, and then, that's what we got.
And then the whole thing fell through, and this version of Ray Earth never came out. And I think Media Blasters picked it up years down the road and released the TV show normally. So happy ending.
Yeah. Very happy ending, because, like I say, I don't remember all the names. I just remember An Enemy was the worst, and the Foo's name was the worst.
What was it? I mean, it sounds like a little bit. You're talking about, you know, chunks of the source code being lost. Anyone who dealt with the Japanese back then, even in anime and stuff like that, constant complaining about the fact that they don't know where the masters are. They don't know where they put, you know, the audio tracks. There's no separate audio tracks for this stuff. It's a little bit of a mess because production is chaotic. Is it like that in video games, too? Was it real hard to get the materials you needed?
It's an ongoing problem. I mean, you know, it's people just, you know, they work on these projects and they archive what they think is necessary. And sometimes they miss whole chunks of it. The Ray Earth one wasn't entirely that they forgot. It's that they had a hard disk crash. And fortunately for them, it was the end of their project, so they didn't care. But when we had to go back to pick up the pieces, you know, we had this corrupted chunk of data missing out of the middle of it. But, preserving the data and having it, you know, saved and stored in a format that makes it worthwhile or workable going forward, it's not always, you know, number one on the list of things to do.
So Working Designs was famous in particular, not just for releasing a lot of role-playing games, but famous for their, unique localizations. I'm curious, what was the process for that? What was the decision to include all of that sort of Western humor? And what was it like dealing with the fans back then?
It wasn't a problem because there was nothing else like it. And the fans that we were shooting towards were receptive of it because they're like, oh my, this reads like nothing else I've ever read. I mean, it was a completely different experience than the localizations they'd seen before. You know, however few of those there were. I just remember that, okay, the text in the games that we strove for, and specifically I strove for, because I was writing most of them, were just conversational speech, just everyday speech, American-style speech. And, if something goes said or mad or whatever, I say they're pissed. Well, I remember when you fought one of the bosses in Cosmic Fantasy II, his name was Nova, the message came on screen is Nova is pissed, and then he went to a boss battle. Well, that was no big deal. Nova's pissed. You know, he's mad, whatever. When it was released, it was like, oh my God, he said pissed. It was a huge deal. People were really like freaked out that there was the word pissed was in a game. It was
wow.
Now it's kind of charming, but back then it was like, why are they getting so upset about this? But then it progressed and it became a little too much, peaking obviously with the infamous Bill Clinton joke.
Right.
And then it sort of subsided to the point where it's very conversational, it's very fluid, like you would see in Ark the Lad or like Alundra or like Growlanzer. But it's not nearly as in your face with the pop culture stuff. It's just more of a conversational speech. And some of the pop culture is still there, but it's a little bit more out of the way than it was in the early Lunar stuff.
You were including all this stuff because you wanted it to just be conversational. Obviously, you were putting jokes in because they were funny. But when did the fans ever start demanding, like, okay, look, stop with this stuff. We just want an extremely literal, straightforward translation, which is what fans demand now. Like, they want it real literal now.
I think some section of the fan base wants it real literal, but I think the general base, I don't think that they necessarily want that. Because the thing is, if you go with a straight literal, sometimes it's really tedious to read. It's not fun. It's not entertaining. And, you know, that segment of the market is there. But, you know, it goes totally overboard, too. You know, you have the just according to Keikaku guys. You know, it's like, what? Keikaku? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Let's get with the program here. So, you know, there's a balance there. But if you go with a straight literal translation, you're going to turn off the segment of the fan base that wants to be entertained and just wants to enjoy the game and the characters and stuff. And still, they're not missing anything in the content of the game, understanding what's going on or what the characters' motivations are, etc. The overarching information is still there. It's just presented in a more accessible, entertaining way to English speakers. But the thing you're talking about with straight up literal translation, that part of the fan base is there, but I don't think they're a major part. I think that they're maybe 25%. And if you try to give it to the 25% straight up literal translations and make it not enjoyable or fun for the other 50% or 75% or whatever, then you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, and I actually remember back when Working Designs was just getting started, literal translations were pretty much the rule for most of the RPGs that we did get over here. Like, you would get something that sometimes didn't even make sense or something that just felt very bland. So when I started playing stuff like Lunar, I was like, oh my, wow, it's like an actual, native English speaker wrote this, not to be rude.
Well, but like I say, the literal translations, especially where it's humorous or comedic, Japanese love puns. They love them. And those puns just do not translate straight across. They don't work right. You have to get the intent and rewrite it to something that will still make a person laugh, but they're not laughing in the same way because of the pun. The Japanese comedy especially is really tough to get across and have it make sense. It's literally a Just According to Kikaku plan where you have like a little parentheses, Kikaku means plan thing underneath it if you try to bring it straight across, because it's not funny. It's more of an academic thing at that point. And if the original intent was for it to be funny, then doing it straight and making it academic isn't really sort of paying attention to the original intent.
Now, another question about the stuff you had to do back in the day. I mean, you got away with saying Boss was pissed in Cosmic Fantasy, but I understand there were other things you had to censor, either at the request of the publishers or something. Like in Cosmic Fantasy, if I'm remembering right, in the Japanese version, one character flips off another character or something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I bet she flips. We had to take that, make it a fist, and that wasn't our doing. That was the terms and conditions for TurboGrafx. Yeah, TTI.
So you worked with.
Go ahead.
Between you worked with NEC and Hudson on the TurboGrafx and Sega on the Sega CD and Saturn, and then with Sony on the PlayStation. Now, in terms of the censorship, naturally it grew less and less as the time went by. But who do you think was the most restrictive of those?
Probably the conversations that I had the most with were it was probably equally split between Sega and Sony. I know that with Sega, we had a conversation for Sega CD Lunar 2. Where I had a really uncomfortable, probably 45-minute conversation about nipples and what was okay and what wasn't okay, because Plantella, the first boss in the Japanese version, had the plant monster who's kind of like a harpy or whatever. She had her upper torso was naked. She had nipples showing. Well, we had to have this conversation about how much nip we could and couldn't show, and we ended up having to like cover up plantish, like the plant came up a little further on her torso. But that was kind of an uncomfortable conversation. And it was a female account manager too. We went on for like 45 minutes talking explicitly and in depth about nipples and what was okay and what wasn't. And it was not good. And then on Sony, we had conversations. They were not quite as uncomfortable, but they were definitely in depth with things like, the Deke Beck page out of, Ark the Lad. Because that was an awesome pun that I just fought for. We got it, but it was tough to get that in. And then we had some lines in Alundra that we had to pull that were also double entendres. That
the ring line. No.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You cough up a ring first, kind of thing. And there's a couple others, but I would say Sega was probably the more uncomfortable conversations that we had, but Sony we had a few too, and we got them all worked out, and the Deke Beck thing flew, which shocked me, but it was fantastic. We were able to get it in.
And for those of you who are wondering what that is, I think the character's name is Deke. It's D-I-E-K or something.
His full name is Deke Beck, but everybody in the game calls him Deke.
Right, and in the manual you put, Sucking Deke, I think.
Yes. Wow. When you because he was a robot, and you transferred, he collected experience, and you could dole his experience out to anybody. You would suck it off of Deke.
Oh my god!
You would take it from Deke and give it to a character on this platform that distributed the experience. So that was the heading on the page, page like 80 something of the manual.
Right.
Became a little bit infamous.
So would you consider those years then, you know, the late 90s, do you feel like that was the last golden era for Japanese role-playing games? Because where we are now, certainly, it is a niche within a niche at this point. But did those seem like golden days back then?
Oh, I mean, for us, absolutely. I mean, we had so much stuff that we wanted to do. It was amazing. And the stuff we were able to get was great. And other publishers were doing great stuff. And it was very, very cool. It was very interesting time with sort of Japanese fandom and interest in the U.S. Market. It was definitely on the upswing. But, I mean, I don't think it's like the last golden age. I think it's like a golden age, because I think that kind of stuff ebbs and flows. And I think that, you know, there is a definite swell that will, you know, come again and is, you know, on the upswing. It just, Japan has to get out of their development funk and decide what they really want to be. And then once they do that, I think it'll be, you know, another golden era will be able to start.
Okay. Wow. So we should get to John here.
Yeah. Hey, John.
Well, I'm in Japan, so I just got up, and you guys are keeping me awake, because that's a pretty interesting story, Vic. That's great stuff.
Which one? The sucking deke?
Yeah, well, the whole thing. Yeah, it's great history, so love to hear it.
So I didn't know this about you. You are the former president of Hudson Soft.
Yes, that's right. Hudson Entertainment in America, yes.
In America. Okay, so, gosh, what was that like?
Well, I worked for Hudson Soft, the parent company, for 20 years total. And so the things that Victor is talking about, TurboGrafx and all that, were part of that era. And, you know, it all goes back in time. But a lot of the crazy stuff that happened during that era happened on the TurboGrafx. There was so many great games, and there's so much potential, really. It's a shame that it ended up the way that it did, because there were basically marketing errors that led to the TurboGrafx demise, and too bad. But Hudson itself was a great company, and we, you know, 20 years at one company is a long time, but I can say that every moment was great, and it was just, it was really thrilling to be not only in that company, but at that kind of level where I could, you know, basically sitting next to the president's office, so I could see what was going on and really live and breathe the Japanese corporation. So, yeah, great. Plus, the history of it is awesome.
So you started with Hudson during the Nintendo era, or was it when they sort of had gone on to the Super Nintendo and the TurboGrafx?
They were just starting I should say they had just, this is 1988 that I was hired. So, so they had already established a PC Engine in Japan, and they were just starting the TurboGrafx in America, and they hadn't started it yet, but they knew that they needed some help, and they needed a foreigner to help with the business. So that's how I got into the business. And it wasn't because I don't have a great story like Victor saying, you know, where I was so into the games. I just happened to be there at the right time and met the right people. So,
right. And Hudson was really heavily involved with the TurboGrafx, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, a lot of people here in America, they sort of forget that and they associate the system with NEC. But Hudson was really behind a lot of the games and a lot of the marketing, too.
Actually, Hudson was the TurboGrafx. Hudson created the machine. They created the actual physical hardware and the middleware, and at the beginning a lot of the software. So what they did is they had this technology, but they were a hardware, you know, they were a software company with hardware expertise, and they didn't want to be put into a hardware war. They weren't that kind of company. They didn't have that kind of capital. Plus, they were making an awful lot of money on Nintendo, or with Nintendo, I should say. So they wanted to license the technology out, and they found NEC. And NEC did a very good job in Japan, as usual. You know, Japanese companies in Japan do wondrous things. But when taken to a foreign country, they tend to try to do it the Japanese way. It doesn't always work. You know, and in this case, it really was, I have to say, it was American's side that didn't play up to the standard, because what happened was there was a lot of tension. If you guys remember the when Sega came out with their machine, and it was a real war, and there was a real kind of enthusiasm for 16-bit machines. And what happened was they overordered. And I think they ordered like 750,000 units on the first go.
And that was just the TurboGrafx itself, right? The original one that used the cards.
Yep. The original TurboGrafx, they ordered 750,000 units. And that kind of straight-jacketed them into having all this hardware that they had to move. Sega was much more nimble and spent most of their money on the marketing. And if you guys remember, they took on Nintendo head-on, and they had the advertisements where they were attacking Mario or, you know, pitting Mario against Sonic and this kind of thing. So so they really understood that in America you have to lead with marketing. The product will follow, but lead with marketing. I hate to say that, but that's the truth.
And I'll add one thing, too. They were also doing crazy stuff on the U.S. side, because I was involved with the U.S. side as I was still in the editorial capacity initially before we started publishing on TurboGrafx. But they did crazy, stupid stuff, like the pack-in title, Keith Courage and Alpha Zones.
Mm-hmm.
That Keith was named after a VP at NEC.
Ah, right.
Come on, guys. That's retarded.
Yeah, that was a really strange thing, because it was an anime-based game, actually, that they'd sort of picked to be a pack-in instead of, I guess, Legendary Axe, which was a better game.
Or R-Type, because that was our choice. Keith Courage or R-Type. Can you imagine choosing R-Type? I mean,
R-Type was an arcade game that everybody played and liked. So
everybody loved it. Yeah, sure. So anyway.
Now, the TurboGrafx and the Turbo Duo, those were really, you said that yourself, those were really big in Japan. I think they were basically, they lasted up until 1995 in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, in America, I think they tried to launch the Turbo Duo, and that just sort of didn't really do too well. And something, I'm not sure if Victor was the one who mentioned this, but there was sort of a tension between Hudson and NEC where they wanted to get rid of the system in America or something. Or is that just a?
It's not really get rid of it. Is they weren't gonna? It wasn't gonna be a full fledged business after a certain point. So they had to wind it down. And because they were in business with Hudson, you know, Hudson kind of said, "Okay, we'll buy it back from you, and we'll basically shut it down." I mean, I don't want to say that in the wrong sense, because I think when Turbo, what was it called, Victor? Turbo.
Which one?
Turbo Technologies.
TTI, right.
Yeah, TTI. When TTI started, I'm sure they wanted to succeed, but, you know, it wasn't going to happen. I mean, they needed a lot of money to really succeed at that point. So.
But they had Johnny Turbo.
Yeah, and as I understand, that was kind of a joke that just got out of control, and they had to do it for some reason.
You mean Johnny Turbo?
Yes, Johnny Turbo. That was kind of their thing. And, well, the thing about the TurboGrafx, though, it was a pioneer, as I understand. It had the CD technology before the Sega CD even came along. So, I mean, as Victor mentioned before, that could do cutscenes. A lot of it was used for this full motion video where it was live action. But when you had anime cutscenes on it, it really looked very impressive.
Yeah, it was actually the very first CD-ROM game machine. So everything that you play now on a CD, it got its roots from the TurboGrafx. And Victor mentioned a game called Ease, which was one of the first titles that I worked on at Hudson. And, you know, it was a great title, really a momentous title. And I think that kind of showed what the machine could do. And you opened up all these imaginations that that were being restricted with ROM-based product. So it was definitely a watershed moment in gaming, and should always be remembered for that, at the very least. Wasn't successful commercially, but did a lot, I think.
I was just going to say, and it wasn't just the anime cutscenes that were awesome. It was also the fact you got CD audio. The arranged music was ridiculous compared to coming from a chip-based platform. It was like, oh my god, like Wonder Boy. I mean, the music was just blew your mind. So the animations were fantastic, but it was also the sound was amazing too, because you were getting basically CD tracks that you had never before gotten in a game. It was definitely a window to what the future of gaming was going to be.
Right. So it was ahead of its time, really, in a lot of ways. And would you also say the price, I guess, was a problem too?
Who are you asking, me or John?
Either one of you. I mean,
go ahead, John.
Yeah, I think I remember it came out. I think it was like $200, $199. Is that what it was?
No. $400.
for the CD attachment too.
The CD by itself was $399.
Okay, well, price is always a problem. I'll tell you that. I was talking about TurboGrafx itself, but you know, I just remember the form factor was a big problem for us because, you know, in Japan, NEC created this nice little sleek square box, mm-hmm. And I'm talking about the PC Engine. And then in America, they came out with this big, long, black, cheap box. And it was like, what did you guys do to this? You know, small is beautiful. And a typical American, make it big and people think there's a lot in it. Well, you can make it small and it'd be much cooler. And I think form factor, I don't want to say it killed it, but it certainly hurt, you know, their chances of creating more of a marketing buzz, I think.
Well, and also the form factor for the CD pack-in was, or the CD add-on was ridiculous because it came in a box that was like 3 feet high. Mm-hmm. It was enormous, and the 3 feet was taken up not with the CD unit itself, but two of those feet were with the carrying case that was put up on end. So instead of shipping it with the CD unit inside the carrying case, they put the carrying case separately, and you ended up with a box. I remember it because I got it from Sears. This is back when Sears had a catalog. It came in a box like 3 feet high. I couldn't believe how big the box was when it showed up. It was like, what the heck?
Yeah. And I think they did that, quite honestly, to compensate for price. Oh, it's such a big thing. And, you know, I mean, if there's such a mentality, I think that's probably why they did that. So anyway, speculation. But anyway, interesting.
Now, this wasn't Hudson's last disk system. After the Turbo Duo sort of ran its course in Japan, they came out with it was called the PCFX.
Uh-huh.
PC-FX, and it looked kind of like a PC, like a PC tower.
Yes.
And it never came out in America, of course, and it kind of only lasted a little while. What do you think happened with that? Was it sort of a misstep, I guess, or were they trying it for an audience that wasn't there?
You know, I think that Hudson was willing to supply NEC with was that NEC? What was that? Let me think about that.
It was NEC, I believe, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think they were, you know... My point is Hudson would try to get money from NEC if they could. I think that was, you know, what do you have next kind of thing? What else can we do? Because NEC kind of saw themselves as a Sony or Microsoft now. You know, they wanted to be in the house. They wanted to teach children about the NEC name. Mm-hmm. You know, there was ulterior motives to putting out a game machine for a company that wasn't known for games or had no real tie to games. So I think... you know, they had burned a lot of money on the first run in America. What else could they do? And they had a lot of success in Japan. So, you know, don't let the American side color the glasses, because I think they did make, you know, quite a bit of money in the U.S. or in Japan for the system. So, but it didn't gain enough traction. I think there was already market leaders who dominated, and at that point, okay, they decided to pull the plug.
And the line look was super ugly. They went with a line look that was like all neon colors, and you had to have like their little color banding at the top of every title, which I understand line look, but it was a stinking, ugly, drug-induced line look. It was really bad.
And you're talking about the TurboGrafx here?
Yeah, I'm talking about the, you know, the games. You know, each game was color-coded by genre, which, you know, again, I totally get that, but the line look was ugly.
Well, my favorite part of TurboGrafx and really what they did was, as I was talking about marketing, you know, they really failed marketing-wise. And Victor hasn't mentioned yet, I can't believe he hasn't, because the best thing that they did, and I'm saying this sarcastically, is the cover art. Look at some of that old cover art. You will laugh your ass off. It is so funny. I mean, how bad could you get? Dungeon Explorer, Bomberman. It was just amazing, and we would see it. We would howl at Hudson. We seriously were like, "You guys have got to be serious!" But we were laughing and crying at the same time because it just did it so poorly.
And it was mostly TTI Turbo Technologies that came up with the box art there.
No. Turbo Technologies, they actually had their stuff together. It was NEC Home Electronics that did that. That was their team that had no experience in gaming or anything, and they just didn't get it. It was just the wrong time, wrong people kind of thing. So,
well, I remember that Carol was asking her daughter, who was like, I don't know, 6 years old or something, which games they should do. That I couldn't believe that.
I didn't want to mention any names, but since you did, wow. Yeah.
I didn't give a last name. I just gave a first name. But okay. One of the people who was in decision-making capacity was using her very young daughter to decide which games to bring over.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'll give you another great example. We had it's still one of my favorite games on the Turbo, on the PC, I'm sorry, on the PC Engine was a game called Kato Ken. It was two comedians that, you know, it was real scatological humor, you know, peeing on people, pooping on people, farting on people. And it was so fun to play. It was just a great Hudson game. And they were like, no, we cannot poop. You know, we cannot show this kind of stuff. Well, at that time, at that era, you could. I mean, it would have made a national marketing opportunity. And so instead of that, they changed it where instead of farting on somebody, you were now spray painting. Mm. And, you know, which is worse, spray painting or vandalizing? You know, I would take farting or vandalizing. I would take the farting over vandalization anytime. So they really messed that game up. And, you know, it turned out to be a horrible game, obviously. So, you know, I think they just didn't get gaming. That's all.
Well, right. That's JJ and Jeff, right? I think, for the record.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, JJ and Jeff. Yep, you know it.
Yeah, so, but they also broke the gameplay because it was dumb in that the original game, you ate burgers and fries to get bigger farts. When they changed it to spray painting, you did burgers and fries to get a longer spray can. It sprayed further. It was like, what? Burgers and fries make my spray can spray further? It broke the game completely.
Mm.
So after the PCFX didn't do too well in Japan, that was Hudson's sort of exit from developing game hardware. Am I right?
Not really. No, Hudson continued to develop middleware. And we would do a lot of one-off things on the hardware side, pedometers and little gadgets that kept, you know, going on for a long time. But middleware was actually a big part of Hudson's business. And a lot of people don't know this, but they actually supplied Nintendo with a lot of their middleware. The N64 was mainly Hudson's middleware. And, you know, I'm sure a part of that lives on today in the Wii. I mean, Nintendo's not a hardware company per se. So I remember at the time they had some middleware, and then Hudson said, hey, look at this. And they said, oh, that middleware's better. Okay, well, we'll use that instead. And so they swapped out middleware, and, you know, Hudson had a very good technology division, both middleware and hardware.
And that was basically the start of when Hudson also was making the Mario Party games for Nintendo, if I'm not mistaken.
When did that start? That was a little bit later. I mean, it was after TurboGrafx.
Right. But the Nintendo 64 was when
Nintendo 64, series. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of people don't know this, but Hudson was the very first, along with Namco, the very first third-party publisher for Nintendo.
Uh-huh.
So Hudson did very, very well with games like Lode Runner. If you're a real geek, you'll know a game called Nuts and Milk.
Yes, and Binary Land, I think, is another one.
Oh, man, you're a geek completely.
Yeah, so I am.
Because that's history-wise, that's the root of Hudson, and that's you know, they got this initial success, and that's what I was talking about at the beginning of the conversation. You know, to be a part of that whole Japanese success story was great, and I wasn't there at that time, but you know, that history is great history, and to hear these guys talk about it, and to hear where they were at that time, and how many people were in this tiny office, and you know, all that kind of stuff is really interesting. I just had dinner the other night with Shin Nakamoto, who is the creator of Bomberman.
Oh.
And he was an old friend, and you know, he will let out some nuggets every once in a while about you know, the early days of he and the Kudo brothers, who were the two founders of the company. And these guys were really, really unique characters, and they did some really crazy things, and they always had a unique sense of themselves, which translated into a unique company. So that's why Hudson was so interesting. They loved to gamble. You know, life is a gamble is what they would say. And so every night they would be gambling at the office, sometimes until 3-4 o'clock in the morning, just between the executives, and, you know, big sums of money going back and forth. And it's because they had money. What else are you going to do with it? You know, you don't want to die with money was the point. And I would probably think they wouldn't think that way these days, but still, you know, they knew what to do. and they had a certain flair and a certain way of life that that transcended the games and really made for a great, great company.
Yeah, and Bomberman is still, I think, Hudson's biggest name, I think. And other people, of course, know them for Adventure Island and
yes.
and the Bonk games as well, I believe.
Yeah, in America. But, you know, in Japan, the one thing that that is, you know, really amazing is that everybody knows Hudson. Hudson is, in Japan, is there's no comparison in the U.S. I mean, a lot of people know EA, but it's even deeper than that. I mean, old men will know it because they know this game called Momotaro.
Oh, yeah.
And, that's such a big, I don't want to say Christmas, but the, you know, Shogatsu means a New Year's game because it would come out right before New Year's, and Japanese have a holiday in the New Year's season, and everybody would pick that game up and play over the New Year's holiday. So it's synonymous with gaming in Japan, and yeah, everybody knows that and Tengai Makyo, Tengai Makyo, but also Takahashi Meijin, who is the character in Adventure Island, and all these things, like I said, that are really woven into Japanese cultural fabric.
I think Star Soldier was also a big one too. Am I right? Or Star Force? Right.
Soldier. Yeah. Super Star Soldier. They had some great shooters back in the day. The games just go on and on and on. Right. It Hudson's the treasure chest for sure. I'd like to see Konami do something with all those, but that's hard to pull out.
Right. One interesting thing I always thought is that that highlights how big Hudson was back in the 1980s. The first video game anime movies that were released, it was a double bill, if I'm not mistaken, with Super Mario Brothers and Running Boy Star Soldier, which was based on the Hudson games, of course. And just to have those two side by side, I mean, I wouldn't say Star Soldier was as big as Mario, but that's certainly something there.
Yeah, well, definitely. You really know your stuff. That's hilarious.
Yeah, there's a reason I asked Todd to come on this one.
okay, that's good. That's really good.
And so you were also with Hudson during the last decade. Is that right? Or is it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
When they set up their U.S. operation. And what was that like? Because you were still releasing games, of course, but it wasn't...
Hudson Entertainment was formed really on the back of Hudson's success with Docomo. The Japanese carrier, cell phone carrier. And at the time, my president, Mr. Kudo, said, hey, go to America, start a company, let's work off the Docomo success. And Hudson had obviously great games for Docomo, and they wanted to bring that to the States. The problem was that the American cell phone market was completely different. Number one and most important was in Japan, the carriers gave us 91% of revenue. And in America, it started, I don't know, it ended up at 50%. So it wasn't a good business. But we still did well. I mean, we did more than just games. We had ringtones. We also did console games. And we also started digital download games, which actually was really successful. And interesting segue, that's how I started Monkey Paw Games, because we had so much success on digital download. I think Hudson was the most prolific digital download publisher. It might even still be with all their virtual console games. But, we just had a lot of success. And we had, we created Bomberman Live for Xbox Live Arcade, which became Game of the Year. And that really opened eyes at Hudson. I mean, even to get that game rolling, it took us like 6 months just to convince Hudson that we should do a game with Microsoft. It was like pulling hairs. So, but eventually everything turned out well. And, Hudson was, revived in America. And remember, this is after games. Victor, help me out. What was that horrible Bomberman game?
Bill
that
Ember. Oh, wait. Oh,
Act-Zero?
Act-Zero. But I was talking about Bill Ember's Combat Basketball. That was a real killer.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think we made a lot of people angry with Act-Zero. And quite honestly, I have to say, the game was not that bad. It's just that it was a Bomberman game, and they shouldn't have messed with that particular brand. They could have called it something else, but by including the Bomberman name in there, I think they really made a big mistake.
Well, and that was on top of Atomic Bomberman, which is pretty crappy too, with the PC one.
Yeah, yep. So we had to bring back the brand. And, you know, bringing back Bomberman, it's not that difficult. You just have to make a multiplayer and, in this case, you know, on live. So it was really, I don't want to call it easy, but it is pretty much an easy game to create for the masses, because that's all you need to do is give them what they want. And funny thing, we based a lot of that off of the Sega version. And, you know, I think that's what people consider the best. And, you know, we took elements of that. We made a little more American. You know, we had, you guys know the game, but, you know, we put them in football suits or whatever you wanted to dress them up as. But the core gameplay was Bomberman.
And you were also doing some new versions of Adventure Island and I think Bonk as well.
Yep.
Around the same time. And I think around the time that Hudson USA closed down, you had Bonk Brink of Extinction in the works.
Yeah, we started Bonk. You know, this is before I left, but I went to Hudson. I said, look, Bonk is a big title. And, you know, we should be doing this for all the consoles, because I think it's one of those titles that definitely has name recognition and be a great title to bring out. And, you know, they weren't so sure. And, you know, there's a lot of times, you know, the Japanese are not really aware of some of the things that they have in their pocket, and they're unaware of the market size. And, you know, so a lot of my job was going back and forth to Japan, trying to convince them that these games actually had potential. And, you know, we didn't care. They made them or we made them. You know, it didn't matter to us. Just get them out there. And so the Brink of Extinction, they allowed us to do as a digital download. We first had it planned as a Wii game. And then we were also going to do PlayStation version and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, finally got it moving on the digital download front. And I left the company right as we got started with that. And the company never brought it out. I think Konami took over. And, you know, at that point, they weren't going to bring any of the titles that were in the pipe. So,
and that was around the time that Hudson's American branch closed down.
No, America lived for a little bit. I think they lived for another year or so. They could have brought that title out. I just don't know, you know, the internal politics of it. I had already left. But,
right. And but now that Hudson's basically part of – sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, things are going down. And now, yes, Hudson is basically part of – Hudson's gone, actually. Hudson I drove by the headquarters the other day, and there's no Hudson sign or anything. It just says Konami. And they had a party this about a month ago. They had a party, a farewell party, where all the old people, people that are still working at Konami still, but, you know, all the old people got together, and it was a big shindig, and, you know, everybody. Hey, that company was like family. You know, if you work for Hudson, you were part of this big family, and the same goes to this day. You know, you were still part of the family, and, you know, your brothers and sisters, you see them around all the time because they're working for other companies now, and you know, just a great experience. I can't say anything bad about Hudson. It was just a superb experience.
Right. So with all of Hudson's properties at Konami, do you think they're really going to do anything with them? I mean, Bomberman is still a perpetually popular game, but I imagine stuff like Bloody Roar is probably not going to come back anytime soon.
You know, I'm in very good contact with Konami. You know, they help me and I help them. So, nothing is out of the realm of possibility, quite honestly. And, you know, Monkey Paw, we're always asking people, hey, tell us what you want. You know, we'll go after it. And, you know, that's kind of our thing, is that we go after a lot of these games that that people haven't been able to see, or that they want a rerun of it, or, you know, remake of it or whatever. And it's hard for American companies to get those games because of the fact that American, or I should say Westerners, don't have the time and patience to deal with the Japanese. And the one thing that Japanese don't want to deal with are impatient people. So it's the reason I'm in Japan here. It's because, you know, I can do business with Americans online, you know, over Skype or, you know, visiting sometimes. But with the Japanese, you have to be in front of them all the time. You have to go out drinking with them. You have to do favors for them. You have to do all these things that prove you're with them, prove that you're not going to run away when the times get tough or when things go bad or when there's a problem. You know, that's what they want, stability. And very few people actually want to live here. They love visiting, but they don't want to live here. They don't want to put that time and effort into building the relationships, which often take years and years to build up.
And I understand some Hudson, former Hudson people have gone over to Nintendo's subsidiary. It's called ND Cube, I think. They made the last Mario Party game.
Yeah, the last Hudson, when I say Hudson, I mean real Hudson president, formed that company, Mr. Endo. And yeah, he's done very well. Again, great brother, or in my case, dad, because he was my president. So, but yeah, they've done very well, and obviously took the Mario Party, not only team, but the license and everything else. And you know, I think that company is now majority owned by Nintendo. And you know, he was very close with Nintendo, anyways. So it's an arm of Nintendo at this point.
So y'all have started up a new thing here. Monkey Paw Games, and you've got a big Kickstarter initiative going that is, I would say, audacious is a good way to put it. The plan is, it looks like, to raise $500,000 to sort of, I don't know how you really put it, because the game's coming out, the game's Clash of Heroes 2, and it's coming out no matter whether or not you meet your fundraising goal or not, right?
As a digital download.
Yeah, basically, the Kickstarter, and that's the confusing part for a lot of people is, it's like, well, if it's coming out, why do you need $500,000? Well, the $500,000 is really less than 7,000 deluxe packs. We made it pretty low so that there was a low threshold, we thought, to get it to fund. So if 7,000 people say they want the deluxe pack, it'll fund. But it also pays for extras that the digital-only localization won't get. So if we fund, then we'll be able to do the dubbing, we'll be able to do the song, we'll be able to improve the game. We'll be able to do like a laundry list of extras and improvements to the game, so the physical and the digital game will be better than just a straight digital download basic localization. And we've been trying to communicate that more clearly as the feedback came back that it was confusing. But I'm still not quite sure the message is out there that it's not an issue of you're going to get the awesome deluxe bonus game with full dubbing and full song translation and everything digitally, because you're not. If we don't fund, there won't be the budget to do those extras. You'll just get a basic localization.
Right, and I think the Kickstarter fundraising goal is getting a lot of the attention there because people see it and they compare it to the other games that have gotten Kickstarters lately, like the Double Fine, where they wanted, I think, 400,000. And people will say, well, why do you need 500,000 to localize a game when Double Fine only needs 400,000 to make one from the ground up?
Well, because that's the difference between console and PC. When you're in a console, you're paying royalties to the console manufacturer. It takes a large portion of the cost. You know, the cost of making it, you pay a pretty substantial royalty to make the game and release it on a console, whereas the Double Fine game was and is a PC-based game where the royalty structure is way lower. The cost structure is way lower than it is to do it on a console. So, you know, that's one cost differential, and then also the fact that, again, we're doing a crazy deluxe pack that's, you know, fantastic and has tons of pack-ins in it and really is above the level of even the stuff that I was doing with Working Designs, because I really wanted to challenge myself to do a really great deluxe pack for it. And that's expensive. It costs money, you know.
Okay. Well, tell us a little bit about Clash of Heroes 2. And another reaction to this was, why do Clash of Heroes 2 when the original came out here and it didn't really get too much of a following? You said Clash of Heroes 2 is greatly improved, I think.
Right, yeah, exactly. The game, when Clash of Heroes 1 came out, I was kind of surprised because Clash of Heroes 2 was available at that time. And so I was like, well, why didn't they just start with Clash of Heroes 2? Because the difference between 1 and 2 is almost night and day, because 2 is so much better. There's a lot of annoying little things that make 1 tedious to play that just aren't present in 2. 2 is much more of just a fun RPG, you know, sort of a wizardry, like a fun riff on the wizardry sort of genre of games. And Clash of Heroes 1, it had the riff on wizardry, but it didn't really have the fun, at least for me. It felt very tedious. And, you know, like, for example, did you play Clash of Heroes 1, either of you?
A little bit.
Okay, you know how when you go dungeon exploring, you get all your stuff, you open treasure chests and everything, and you have a whole bunch of stuff that's classified as worth nothing, and you have to go back to town to have it appraised before you find out what it is, and you waste money appraising it, then you find out you got a piece of crap, and then you got to sell it or get rid of it anyway.
Right, that's kind of an old school holdover, I guess.
Yeah, but it's old school tedium. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. It should not have been used. It's like, that's one thing we don't want to bring back. And Classiferous 2 doesn't have that. I mean, you get your stuff, you know what it is. You don't have to go back and pay money to find it. You got a piece of crap. It took that tedious step, which was a really major annoyance for me. I hated it. It's gone. It's not there. And then a lot of the confirmation stuff that goes on back and forth, you know, like the way the healing is set up is different in Classiferous 2, so it's not so annoying. And it's not so expensive to heal your guys when you bring them back to town. The monsters, more monsters. I mean, basically, it's bigger, better in all respects. But the tedious aspects of the first one, I think, are substantially reduced to the point where it becomes the fun game that I think it was intended to be.
Now, Classiferous 2, it's like you said, it's in style of wizardry, it's sort of a dungeon hack. How strong is the story in Classiferous 2? Would you say comparable to the first one, or because dungeon hacks really aren't known for being as story driven as, say, like Lunar or Final Fantasy?
No. Yeah, it's not. Not as story-driven as a Lunar or Final Fantasy, but 2 has definitely a much stronger story than the first one. It definitely has a destination where it's going, and it also talks or deals with what happened after the first one and what happened to the school in the first one. You know, I don't want to spoil anything about what happens, but it definitely has a story, and there's definitely a direction that the whole plot line goes in the course of doing all these quests, you know, 140-odd quests. The story develops, and you find out some pretty cool stuff. It's definitely much more story-driven than the first one. I mean, it's obviously less than a Lunar or a Final Fantasy, because that's just the style of game that it is, but it's much more story-driven than the first game was.
Yeah, so the thing about this to me that strikes me as very interesting, as someone who's, you know, I'm in my early 30s, I've been playing video games since I was, you know, 5 or whatever, and the heyday, as we said, the heyday of the JRPG really kind of was the late 90s, and Final Fantasy VII kind of exploded it. Back then for a while, and for that generation they really dominated as a genre, and that has really gone away. And your Kickstarter page really reads like a manifesto that this is intended to prove that there is still a big audience for these and people still want these to happen. And I'm curious, could you expand on that a little bit, or just tell us, obviously this means a lot to you, and I want to know, you know, a little bit more about that.
Well, I mean, honestly, when that was written, that was exactly what it was intended to be, was, you know, a sort of a statement of this is where we're at and this is where we would like to go as a fan community, as a fan of these kind of games. This is what we'd like to see happen. I think after we launched, it became clear that it was a little too much manifesto and a little not enough details. So we've been working on the details of the project. You know, we put the gameplay video up on the Kickstarter page so you can actually see the game in action. And we put in the details of what was actually in the deluxe pack. There were some things that fans wanted to see that were not covered by sort of the history of this is where we are and this is where we're going, which is really what it was intended to be. I mean, as you know, pretty much like you, I mean, I grew up loving those kind of games. And the stuff I did at Working Designs was done out of a love for the games, wanting to present them. Because, you know, in Japan at the time, we're talking 80s, early 90s, the kind of deluxe packs we did here were not that uncommon there. I mean, we actually eventually exceeded a lot of what was done. And in fact, Japanese fans were importing Lunar back to Japan because they liked our deluxe packs, which was a fantastic compliment.
Wow.
But yeah, it was when I found those in store in Akihabara, where they were reimporting them back in. And I was like, holy crap, they're reimporting our game to sell the fans. It's amazing.
That's interesting.
It was awesome. But that was done out of a love for the game and for wanting to give the U.S. RPG fans the experience that the Japanese gamers were getting that we weren't getting here. And that's kind of where that whole deluxe pack stuff started. And, you know, other publishers picked up on it and it kind of grew, but it's kind of turned into this weird thing where, and that's why it explicitly talks about it in the Kickstarter, that, you know, now they're saying, well, here's a deluxe pack and you get a code for some armor. Well, I don't want a deluxe pack where I get a code when I open the box. That's crap. I want like a deluxe pack that's like, oh, look at all this awesome stuff related to the game. You know, that experience of opening the box and going through each of the things that are in the box that are related to the game, for me, that's a really strong experience when I get any deluxe, you know, Japanese collector's edition or U.S. even. But the U.S. side has kind of drifted towards, you have two classes now. You have the kind where it's quote-unquote deluxe, and you have this little flimsy book that's supposed to be an art book and a code, or you have crazy deluxe that's like $150 and you've got like, you know, a giant, you know, statue of a dragon or something. That more sane middle ground, I think, has kind of disappeared. And that's what this Kickstarter was sort of supposed to address, is, you know, hey, if these fans are out there and they want these kind of physical deluxe packs, basically like working designs plus, that's what we want to do. And that's why we started the Kickstarter.
Well, okay, I mean, I just wanted to say, like, it's no wonder the Japanese were reverse importing your games. I mean, the Japanese love of punching dolls is legendary.
Yeah, I think they were more after it for Lucia's pendant, but yeah, the punching doll is pretty cool too.
Todd, go.
I think that's one thing that you know, people who know RPGs and people who know Victor can kind of get a sense of, maybe it wasn't enunciated correctly, but get a sense of what we're trying to offer. And I think there's confusion on that front that we've tried to address with some of the additional information that we put out. So, you know, I think getting that out and spreading the word and making people know what we're really trying to do here and letting people really see what's going to be involved in this product is the most important thing. So, you know, spread the word is key for us.
Right. And so right now you're at about 67,000, it looks like, and you got 2 weeks left. What's the plan? Are you remaining optimistic? What's the plan after this?
Well, I mean, of course it's never stay die. I mean, that's why we added the video today, because fans have been asking for the video, and you know, I didn't want to put a video out there that was primarily Japanese. And at this point, that's all we had, because we're doing the text localization right now. So we didn't have a version that was running with English in it. So, but the fans were like, look, we just want some gameplay. And because the game is so text heavy, there wasn't any YouTube videos about people playing the game. So they couldn't just look it up. And also they had trouble because it wasn't called Class of Heroes in Japan. So they couldn't look up the Japanese name. But even if they could, they still have trouble finding it. So anyways, we put the video up, which is a fan request. It took us about a week to get the art assets we were missing from Acquire and to collect all the battle scenes and put them all together and make the video look nice. Got that up, and then we got some more details, explicit details on what's in the deluxe pack. Here's what's in it. Here are the three, the users, the backers will get to vote off of a list of additional items. They'll be able to basically pick three, and the three that have the highest votes will be packed into the product as well. But yeah, I mean, we're basically just spreading the word far and wide. It's a never say die sort of attitude. If it funds, it funds. Great. We'll be able to do the full localization we want to do with the dubbing and the song translation and everything to make it really nice in sort of a working design style way, sort of the full package. If it doesn't fund, then we just, you know, we say, look, the fans have spoken. We did everything we could do to make it attractive, and we couldn't get those 7,000, you know, deluxe packs that we thought was a pretty small threshold, that maybe it's too much, or maybe it's an issue of we haven't got the word out enough. So we're going to try to spread the word, get it out far and wide, and try and come up with those 7,000 deluxe packs we need to make it hit that funding goal. And then it's all good. If it doesn't fund, then we'll just release a basic localization digitally and move on.
Now, as far as the localization goes, I mean, you said that the full one will have dubbing and all that. Are you planning on making it any more difficult or anything like that? Because that was also something Working Designs was known for back in the 1990s. You made games a little harder as well.
We didn't necessarily make them harder just for the sake of making them harder, unless it was an accident. Vi, the wind elemental in Vi was an accident.
But
obviously the flow of the game was ruined kind of a little bit, because you went from, you know, not bad, not bad, but not bad, ridiculously impossible, not bad, not bad, not bad. But generally with Working Designs, the stuff that I did with Working Designs or any RPG that I approach, I just want to have a good experience. And if bosses take too long to kill, it's not a good experience for me. I don't like that. I would rather have a really tense, you know, battle that lasts, you know, 10 or 15 minutes than a battle that lasts an hour. Mm. So, you know, like in Alundra, the final boss in that, in the Japanese version, it was super boring because you would just run up, hit, back off, run up, hit, back off. And that battle took forever. It was ridiculous. So we made the boss harder only in that if you got nicked or you got hit, you took a lot more damage, so it was more easy to die. But each hit you did land took more damage on him. Mm-hmm. So it compressed the battle down and made it more reasonable to, you know, 10 minutes or 15 minutes instead of like a half hour. So, yeah, it's not an issue of making it difficult for the sake of making it difficult. It's an issue of trying to balance it between difficulty and you know, too easy. You're trying to hit that balance. But like I say, Class of Heroes as it stands right now, there's really only been one boss battle that I thought was crazy, and I don't think I would change it. I mean, where we're at the moment with the game as it shipped in Japan, I think they did a pretty good job of balancing it and also not making it so you had to grind too much. Because that's one thing that I really don't like doing is grinding.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, dungeon hacks are basically, they're supposed to be hard to a certain extent, so I understand that if it's already pretty difficult.
Yeah, well, but the thing is, it's not so difficult that it's not fun. It's still, if you play the game as, you know, without warping around and skipping battles and stuff, if you just go through the dungeons and get point A to point B, you pretty much will do okay as long as your party is equipped with the right stuff and you've stayed current on all your stuff, all your, you know, equipment, and you've checked out, you know, whatever alchemy is available at that point. As long as you've sort of played the game as it's meant to be played, the flow of the game is actually really nice. I mean, it's a lot of times I'll be playing and I'm like, oh my God, I got to change that. I got to change that. I got to change that. I haven't had those experiences with the actual core gameplay. The changes that I would like to make are all interface based, you know, too many confirmation boxes, no shortcut buttons. I'd like to hotkey the spells, you know, things that make it easier on the player. But the actual flow of the game is actually very well balanced, I think.
Okay, and for the dubbing, would you use a particular studio that does the games already, or would you sort of do it with Working Designs?
Well, right now, a lot of the Working Designs sort of regulars are ready to go. And then if it gets to be too much and we have, you know, casting beyond what I can get with the, you know, sort of the regular Working Designs actors that I've used before, we would put right with the overflow to another studio. But definitely one we've used before, we wouldn't probably try a new studio.
Okay. So, well, before we get to Twitter, I just, you know, part of this does read as a manifesto. And I'm curious, when you look out at the landscape right now of gaming and video gaming, obviously now is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's bigger than anyone could have really ever predicted. When you look at the way Japanese role-playing games are in the American market right now, what do you think people are doing wrong, either on our side or on the Japanese side?
I think it's a number of issues that have kind of come together to sort of make it difficult. You have the issue of retail sort of monopolies growing up, taking up large sections of the sort of gaming retail space like GameStop, where a quote-unquote niche will only end up getting as many orders as they have pre-orders for. So you'll have situations where, you know, this large chain only orders one copy per store, and that one copy is pre-ordered. So the game never actually makes it to the shelf for a new customer to see. But they're more than happy to sell that game used when it comes back in for $5 less than full price. You know, it's sort of a sabotage of the smaller genres, and RPGs have definitely fallen victim to that. They're underordered, both because they don't want to take the risk on it, and because if they're underordered, then that sort of forces people to buy it when it comes in used. And that's a bad thing, a really bad thing. And then also the lessons learned with localization have not spread to everybody in the industry. There's still plenty of bad localization. I mean, it's crazy. You'd think with the history of bad localization and audio atrocities as a reference that they could just click on their computer and hear all the bad localization and say, hey, we don't want to do that. But there's still plenty of really, really bad localization out there. There's good localization, but there's not enough of it. And you would think in, you know, 2012 that there would be enough awareness to do it well. Because, I mean, I know that when I play an RPG, if it's tedious to play and it's not fun because the writing is bad or the acting is atrocious, it doesn't make me want to finish it. I have to be involved in the game. I have to really be involved with the characters. And those kinds of things, for me, are a barrier to really integrating with the game and really wanting to finish it. But yeah, I think that's the primary issues that are holding RPGs back or reducing the RPG niche rather than growing it are retail, under-ordering, or not ordering at all. And, you know, because sometimes a publisher will say, hey, we're thinking about doing this game. You know, what do you think about it? And they'll get a negative reaction from the buyers, and it'll just get killed before it even comes out or even gets underway. under-ordering or not ordering, and then also the localizations not really being engaging on a lot of them. Not all of them, but there's still too many in this day and age that have poor localizations that don't really get people involved. But that was the thing that was so exciting about doing this Kickstarter is we can bypass those roadblocks. If we can go straight to the fans and the fans say, hey, we want this, we're going to support this, we can deliver it digitally either as a basic localization or as a deluxe localization and deliver it physically straight to fans. So they can get exactly what they want. They're not going to have their pre-order stuff stolen by an employee or, you know, passed off or sold on eBay or whatever before they ever get it. They're going to get their stuff and they're going to get the deluxe pack and they're going to get the games they want. So that's why this model was exciting for us, because it's like, hey, this is the way. This, we can bypass all these roadblocks and help grow this genre again.
Now, what do you think of the RPG market in Japan or among the Japanese developers? I think you mentioned earlier that they have to basically decide what they want to be.
Yeah, they're stuck. They're being told, or they're by maybe their managers who maybe aren't gamers themselves. They're being told, look, you know, you need to make a Western style game. But if that's not who they are, if that's not what they are as creators, then the Western style game they make will suck. And we've seen examples of, you know, attempts like that that just have not worked out.
Like, was it Quantum Theory or something?
There's too many to count. There's so many ones that where they try to be Western and they just can't do it. So my feeling is that when Japan was the strongest in RPGs is when they just did what they did. They did games that they felt were cool and that they felt were neat. And they came out with all sorts of crazy concepts and cool sort of scenarios that we just didn't have in Western games. And that was so attractive to me as a teenager. It was like, it just blew my mind. And I think the reason they're in their funk, and this is completely my personal opinion, but my belief is their funk is that they have an identity crisis. They're being externally told, you need to be this, 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 this. But creatively, their heart is somewhere else. And so trying to adapt those two is making a product nobody wants in the end. You know, because they're not happy. The Western gamers aren't happy. Why do it? You know, make the game that you feel passionate about. And I think that players will appreciate it. And you maybe they'll blow some more teen minds now. You know, that's really the ultimate goal, is make games that people are just like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is amazing.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, is there a specific example of like a game you think where it's like, okay, this is the result of total confusion on their behalf?
I could name a whole bunch, but I don't want to dog anybody, so I'm not going to say.
All right, okay.
But
you know what I'm talking about. There's a lot of them out there.
Mm-hmm. You can find Japanese developers trying to make a Gears of War clone, which I think we've seen a few of those already, and those have been kind of strange.
Yeah, like I say, they just need to decide who they are and who they want to be and just be that, because trying to be something they're not is clearly not working.
Now, what do you think of the rise in RPGs that sort of are crossbred with dating sims? I mean, we've always had games like that. Like back in the 90s, you had Sakura Wars and stuff. But we seem to be seeing in the past few years a lot more games that, well, they're being sold sort of on the attractiveness of the characters, and the female characters are positioned as girlfriends for the player.
Yeah. I think it's like moe overload, man. I mean, it's too much. It's mucho moe overload time. We don't want any more of that. But I think, you know, I think it's a fad, like everything. I mean, maybe John can speak more to this than I can because he's there. But on the U.S. side, you know, I'm like, okay, I get it. And, you know, some people have actually complained, oh, you know, the Class of Heroes stuff is too moe as well. But on the moe scale, the Class of Heroes stuff is pretty tame.
Right, because you're not really dating the characters or anything like that, are
well,
you?
Well, and it doesn't – no, you're not. And it doesn't, like, you know, just sort of, like, overwhelm you. The crazy moe stuff that they've got going on in Japan, the hardcore stuff, is just, like, it's too much. And I think it's a fad. I think it'll fade. But that also goes back to the thing about deciding what the creators want to be. That's another external influence in Japan that they're being told to copy probably by their producers or directors. And so the creative people are going out, and that's what they're doing. But I don't think that most of them want to be doing that. I think that they have other ideas and ambitions. And I think that eventually those people will rise through the ranks enough that they can assert their vision on the next generation. That's why I say I really think that another golden age of RPGs is coming. It's just we've got to get through this funk that we're currently in. And that's why we're trying to help with this Kickstarter to really sort of, you know, push the industry here in the right direction. But go ahead, now, John. Go ahead and comment on the moe thing if you want to, John.
I think you hit it. I was going to say the same thing. It's a fad. It's a very, very big fad, and there's a lot of money being generated. If you go to Akihabara, you can't get by without being harassed by the Moe Moe girls, you know, which is okay, but you can tell that it's already wearing down on its end because there's just too much of it. And you can only bombard people for so long before they say, okay, well, what's next? And remember, Moe Moe came out years and years ago. I don't know when its genesis was, but yeah, I think it's on its last legs. It'll continue for a while, but it won't be the driver that it has been for the last, you know, 4 years or so.
Hey, John, do you want to take this opportunity to announce that we're doing My Wife?
Oh, my God. Oh, I love Plus. Would you localize that, too?
You don't think that's a good idea? We shouldn't do a Kickstarter for My Waifu?
My Wife? I got approached for that title, and, you know, I didn't know it when I first heard it, and then I mentioned it to Victor, and he started laughing. He's like, what?
Okay. I was like, that's notorious for everything that's wrong with games.
But yeah, I hate to be a cynic, but you probably would have already reached your fundraising goal.
Oh, God. Oh, I hope
depressed
not.
Me a little bit more.
Sorry.
Well, now, John, you mentioned Akihabara, and I was going to bring up another game by Acquire, the developers of Class of Heroes. I think they also did Akiba Strip.
They did, yep. Mm-hmm.
Right, and you've mentioned that you are using this as a test, and you may want to do other RPGs. And one of the reactions I have been seeing to the Kickstarter is, well, people can be a little cynical because they're asking, why didn't they do Seventh Dragon? Why didn't they do Valkyria Chronicles or Terror of the Stratus or all these games that are with bigger publishers? And you've mentioned, I believe, that Acquire was a company that was pretty much one to do this. And do you think other companies would want to go along with it?
I think that's... First of all, Acquire is a great grounded company. They really know what's going on, and they, you know, my contacts there are completely behind us. They want to see, and believe me, all Japanese companies want to see their products sell in the West. They need the West, but they also sometimes don't know how to bring it to the West. And Acquire is not a publisher in the West, obviously. So, you know, we offer a great partnership for them. But I think that's kind of the message that we're going to deliver with this Kickstarter and with the success of Class of Heroes itself, that there is a market. If done properly, these games can sell well. So we need to be noticed. We need to have some success in order to spread that word. And I think all the Japanese companies are seeing Kickstarter now. They're seeing what we're trying to do with Acquire. Believe me, they're very up on everything. So it's not like this is under the radar. They're seeing what Kickstarter is, and they're seeing what we're doing with the Japanese title. And for better or for worse, they're going to take notice and move or not move on the success that we have. So if you want big titles, yeah, make this a success, and that'll breed other titles for sure. Whether we do them or not, it'll breed titles.
Now, Acquire is basically, they're known for the Tenchu games, The Way of the Samurai, I think.
Yep.
They haven't really done too many RPGs apart from their Wizardries. Didn't they do the last Wizardry game?
Yeah, they have a collection of Wizardry games. And, you know, they're, like I said, they're a typical mid-level company that's had some good success. But every company needs the West to survive at this point.
Well, and a lot of people don't know that they have a Game Arts connection. They're owned by the company that owns Game Arts now, Gung Ho.
Oh, yeah. Now, one question I had actually about Gung Ho, and are they currently the owners of the Lunar brand name, like completely, or is there another company involved?
Lunar is, there's other companies that are involved. Kadokawa has part ownership in Lunar. And I know what your next question is going to be, so let me answer it for you. You know, we've been trying to get Lunar, and it's probably, you know, it's definitely in our top three requests, you know, from our users, that games that they want to see. And, of course, our tie with Victor is very strong, so it just makes sense. But it's a complicated license, and a lot of these licenses are similar in that there's two or three or five different license holders, and you have to get them all to sign on. And when you get everybody to sign on, you're splitting the pie so much that it then becomes, not interesting for them to move it. That's not exactly the case with Lunar. We keep our foot on the pedal with this all the time. So it is a complicated one. I can't go into too much detail other than to say eventually we'll get it.
Okay.
Eventually, through time, through persistence, through me being here all the time taking these guys out, we better get it.
Right, because Yeah. Is it true that they were at Studio Alex, I think, who helped develop the original Lunar, they sued Game Arts or something? I understand if you can't answer that, but that's kind of what I heard.
Well, it's public record. It ended badly. I mean, they sued and they lost, and Game Arts won, and Studio Alex ceased to exist.
Yeah, and this might be why Lunar really wasn't a big thing for Game Arts for a while. They did the Grandia series a little more.
Well, Lunar, I mean, my personal opinion is a Lunar without Studio Alex or the people in Studio Alex somehow involved is not really a Lunar. So, I mean, I think that's really the day that Lunar, moving forward, died. You know,
right.
Hopefully it can be put back together at some point. But you know, maybe now that Gung Ho is you know, bought Game Arts and they sort of are their umbrella, maybe that'll help. But you know, the day Studio Alex ceased to exist was a very sad day. Mm.
And was that around the time that they were trying to make Lunar 3, I think? You mentioned that was in the works at some point.
It was happening during that time. During that time, there was a number of starts and stops with Lunar 3. And
the Over the Rainbow thing?
Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to say too much about it because I don't know how much is even out there. But I know that the design document for the Lunar 3 that was going to move forward, that thank God didn't, was terrifying.
Wow.
But like I say, there was a bunch of stuff that happened in the background there, and you know, Studio Alex ceasing to exist really sort of stuck a stake in the heart of Lunar, and it's really unfortunate. I think that one day it'll get put back together so that the creative parties that are involved will get back together, and there will be another one, but you know, I have no idea when that'll happen.
And one other thing about Monkey Pond Guide Works, I believe you guys are still putting stuff on the PSN and stuff like that, PlayStation Network?
Yes, yeah, sure.
So in addition to doing Classifiers 2, you're still going to be having some games on there. And one other thing, Victor, Guide Works was actually working with Sunsoft as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
Some games.
Well, we were trying to sort of revive the Sunsoft brand, and that sort of petered out. I mean, you know, we had a business plan. We were actually executing on it. We brought some of the virtual console stuff out, and it was doing really well. It was well received. People were very happy to finally see Euphoria. We had a bunch of those stuff on deck, ready to come out, like Mr. Gimmick, finally.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
That's
yeah,
a great one.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of stuff that people wanted that was lined up. We were doing pretty well that first year, but my contract with them was only for 1 year. It was like, okay, we'll do a year and then we'll go from there. And after that first year, they said, well, we're going to handle the marketing ourselves. And they, you know, so we turned the assets back over to them, you know, the website and everything else, back to them, and nothing happened.
Oh,
so,
wow.
I mean, I don't know what's going on internally with them, but I know that we had a really good start and things were going places. But honestly, you know, it's one of those things where it worked out for the best kind of situation, because if I had been busy reviving the Sunsoft brand, basically being de facto Sunsoft US, then I wouldn't have had time to do what John and I are doing. And that was sort of simmering, but it hadn't really come to a boil. And then once, you know, we had the time to dedicate to it, we really sort of put a big push on to get it going. And so what we're doing now is sort of a direct result of that Sunsoft thing not working out. So, I mean, I think we actually, or Gaijin Works for sure, ended up in a better place, I believe. And I think fans will as well. Unfortunately, they wouldn't get to see Mr. Gimmick, but maybe that'll happen someday.
And Sunsoft still has the rights to Telenet's old catalog, and that includes like Cosmic Fantasy, El Viento, Valis, and stuff like that too, right?
Yeah.
I'm
a little bummed out about that, because I pushed to get that to happen, and then because I was pretty sure that was, you know, we were going to have this really great renaissance, and it didn't happen, and so now they've got the rights to the Telenet library. But at least I know where they are.
If I
need to go get them, I can pick them up from them. But it is a little depressing. They're sitting there languishing with them now.
I think the solution here is to get Sunsoft to develop another Batman game. I think you'd be set.
Oh, my God. Oh, that was another title. That was another title that the original NES Batman that took almost that whole year to get the license worked out to re-release it. That was another of the titles that was on deck to come out. We finally did it, and then they went away.
Oh,
all right. We got a bunch of Twitter questions, so we got to get to these.
Okay, cool.
Okay. All right. Twitter. First up from Michael Toole, he asks, Victor, you still have a copy of the old Magic Knight Ray Earth anime pilot episode. He's been looking for that for years.
He's probably talking about that reel we got for the first season where they wanted to change all the names. Yeah, I've got it. I don't know where it is, but I definitely still have it.
You should dig that up sometime.
Now, how much of that did they do? Did they do a full episode, or was it just sort of a trailer?
I think it's the whole episode.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure. But, I mean, is that – that's not on the internet? People don't
know?
No,
it's not.
Surprisingly, nobody's ever seen it?
You probably have the only copy.
Well,
they probably destroyed it.
So now here we go. Fund our Kickstarter and I'll release it.
Oh, man. There you go. Put that out there.
No, but I don't want to, I got to make sure I've got it. But I'm just joking. But I do have that tape. I never got rid of it. But yeah, they sent us a copy to, you know, make us change the names. And I didn't know that it hadn't ever been released on the internet or somewhere else.
No, that's one of those, the people that hunt down forgotten old dubs. That's kind of, it's a little bit of a white whale.
I've got a Cobra Legend one, too.
Oh, wow.
Oh, is that the one? Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead. You mean a Space Adventure Cobra?
Yeah. Well, it's Cobra Legend is the dub. Yeah, I don't know if that was released either, but I got a dub of that Sony sent me when they were trying to do a digital comic with us.
Oh, in the 90s?
Late 90s, yeah.
Oh, yeah, because they did come out with a Cobra game for the Sega CD here in America, too, but you weren't involved with that, were you?
No, that was a port of the PC Engine one. It was a really bad, actually. That one's featuring audio atrocities for really bad voice acting. Check. It's horrible.
But this was a different thing with Cobra?
No, this is an actual animated series. It's a fully dubbed animated episode.
Oh, okay.
In English, with the English theme and everything.
It might be the one they dubbed for the Playboy Channel back in the 1980s. But yeah, it'd be very interesting to see, though.
Chio Dori asks, do you have any plans to release games physically? Or is it just download at this point? If the Kickstarter doesn't go through, eventually do you want to be doing physical publication?
Well, Kickstarter is really a test of is there a market for it. You know, if the Kickstarter doesn't fund, then no, we're going to be digital straight out because that's what the fans say they want by not supporting a physical release. But, you know, if it funds and there's, you know, we fund this and we do the physical release, then of course we'll do another one. As long as the support is there, we'll continue to offer a physical release with the digital, you know, in an awesome deluxe fashion. But, you know, if the fan support isn't there for physical release, then, you know, the fans have spoken. It's you're beating your head against the wall. And if we did it through retail, it wouldn't fly because we're back to the issue of not ordering enough product, you know, under-ordering, not bringing it at all. All those issues I talked about earlier come into play with sort of where we are with niche genres in 2012. So that's another reason this Kickstarter is very important because it's sort of the the starting point of really kind of turning that around.
Okay.
And the Kickstarter and the digital release are completely separate, basically, because I noticed even with the donation levels, you don't really get even the lowest donation levels don't really get you a digital copy.
No, because we can't mix those two things because, okay, for example, if we offered an unlimited a digital copy at, say, the $30 tier or whatever, mm-hmm. and we funded with just, say, 200 deluxe packs and, 10,000 digital only, then it throws out of balance the cost that it costs to make the deluxe packs for those people that order them. And our cost per deluxe pack goes up exponentially, and we could end up losing money because we have to make, you know, even though we funded mostly based on digital release and not on physical. But we still have to fulfill those physical products regardless of how much it costs per unit. So it throws the Kickstarter out of balance. Do you see what I'm saying?
Mm.
Yeah. Do you follow me? You sound like you don't.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, interesting.
So the less deluxe packs we make, the more the cost per deluxe pack goes up because it's an economy of scale. The more you make, the cheaper they are. So if we make a digital level and then that digital level sells a lot – and the physical level sells 500 or 1,000. We still have to make 500 or 1,000 of those deluxe packs, but at a greatly increased cost, maybe 3-4 times what they would have cost if they were done in volume of 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 units. So that's why that isn't offered there.
That's why they're separated.
Exactly.
All right. Daryl Surratt asks, will Monkey Paw localizations mirror working designs, or does the relative success of Atlas and NIS mean that there will be less contemporary humor?
We kind of already covered that. I mean, yeah. Working Designs is me pretty much because I wrote or edited every single game we did. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's basically a continuation of that. But a lot of people that are hung up on the contemporary references in Working Design stuff haven't necessarily played some of the later Working Designs game. They're hung up on the stuff we were doing with Sega CD in the maybe mid-90s. Because the, you know, as we talked about before, the style evolved as we went on, and Alundra, Ark the Lad, Growlanzers are very muted compared to some of the crazy in your face pop culture stuff of the earlier games.
And one thing I've noticed about working designs games is that usually when it's a serious plot point or even the serious storyline, there's not a lot of humor or modern day references injected into it. Like Elemental Gearbolt, for example, that was pretty much a straight on and accurate adaptation.
But it was still well written in a conversational, exactly. A conversational English style rather than a straight translation. So we definitely did the normal working design stuff in that we adapted it. But yeah, I mean, the tone of the game dictates, you know, how much of that you see. But even a crazy wacky game is not going to have a Shannon Doherty reference or a Bill Clinton reference or something like that. I mean, it's just an evolution of the style. You know, when we started, we were, you know, blazing a trail. I mean, nobody was doing what we were doing, and we definitely influenced the kinds of localizations you see now. I mean, 100%, I feel that, you know, that was because of what we did. If we hadn't done that, then you'd still be stuck with a lot of really crappy translations for a lot longer than you were. Yeah. Our style evolved as well. I mean, we started with no rules, and we kind of made the rules up as we went, and we found out what worked and what didn't. But that took us, you know, 10 years. The style we had by the end of the 90s was pretty much the style we've gone with since.
I do have to ask on that note, Elemental Gearbolt, do you think that would even be feasible on a PlayStation Network download because it's a gun game?
No, it's not. There's no support for light guns. If they had, if they built in light gun support, on the Vita, they're talking about, PS1 compatibility. And supposedly it's been held up because of they're redoing the emulator or whatever. My hope is that they're building an emulation support for touchscreen gun games, because then you could do Elemental Gearbolt as a Vita download as a PS1 title. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, just speaking briefly to the quality of those working designs translations, play one of those and then go play the original Chrono Trigger translation.
Chrono Trigger wasn't
it's
too
pretty,
bad. I was
it's
thinking,
pretty bad.
Try out the Paladin's Quest or something, or Breath of Fire 2. I think, is one of the worst on the Super Nintendo, but sorry.
Okay, related to your touchscreen thing, Invalid Name asks, any chance, any ideas or plans on bringing things to the iPad?
I mean, maybe. I mean, I'm really, you know, personally, talking for Gaijin Works, I'm really in love with sort of the console experience, portable and otherwise. Mm. But I understand sort of the casual gaming thing that's happening with iOS. And, you know, I play those myself, not necessarily RPGs, but casual games. But, you know, it's hard to deny that that's where a lot of the market is going. So, you know, I don't think it's out of the question, but, you know, I really love the sort of experience of a traditional console or traditional portable console. But, John, you have something to add?
I didn't quite hear the question. Sorry if you heard that.
About iOS support.
iOS, I think it's a different market, quite honestly, because cores aren't going to leave the console. You know, it's hard to chase both. You know, you have to be dedicated, I think, and obviously we're very dedicated. So, you know, you could do some things, but I think a real iOS game or Android game has to be developed for that particular machine and not for just a translation. I don't think it's so important for people to have it on the go. I think it's more for our core market. They're willing to sit in front of a TV for more than 5 minutes, so you kind of know where that's going. I think it's we're not casual, we're definitely core.
All right. Okay, Land of Obscusion asks, was there any animosity between Victor and Bernie Stoller, since Stoller was known to be anti-2D and quirky?
I don't have any personal animosity. I mean, I really still feel that he killed the Saturn before its time, and, you know, a lot of great product was lost because of that. But, I mean, personally, no, I don't have any personal animosity. I mean, you know, he was really difficult to work with because he was not focused. He was not game friendly. He was not gamer friendly. He was straight up, you know, this is slash and burn business. And because he wasn't sort of gamer friendly and he was not a gamer himself, he just made some bad decisions for gamers. And you know, it really affected the platform, especially the Saturn. They killed it more than a year too early. And for that dead year, just nothing came out. It was awful. But personal animosity, no. No, I don't. I have some great stories, but I don't have any personal animosity.
Okay. And similarly, he also asks, were the rumors of the SCEA's anti-2D policy during the PS1 and PS2 days true to an extent or just exaggerated?
PS1 was absolutely true. Yeah, when Bernie was there and maybe up till just a little bit after, it was absolutely 100% true.
Now,
PS2, not so much. PS2 was more an issue of graphic, you know, wanting to have a certain look. So it wasn't necessarily anti-RPG. It was just that RPGs didn't necessarily have the best eye candy.
Is it true that the PS1 anti-2D policy was kind of relaxed? I think you had a guy from SNK came on board, and he brought over a bunch of their fighting games.
It was definitely relaxed. I'm saying initially because we tried to get Arc the Lad like right off the bat, and I actually flew to Japan to meet with Sony Japan to try to get around Bernie Stoller's sort of, you know, mandate or whatever. And they were like, look, you know, we have to work within the structure we have, and this is what being said on that side, so we can't go around, but we can try to work with you to get this to come out. But it took years after he was gone to make that happen. I mean, you saw Arc the Lad. It took forever to get it out.
It was 2001, right? The whole collection?
You finally got the collection out. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But we were trying to get like the original game, and that was the first time we came up against the anti-RPG, anti-2D sort of policy. And it was definitely, maybe not written down in stone, but it was definitely a policy. And that was not coming from Japan. It was coming from the U.S. side. So, you know, back to the Bernie thing, I don't have any personal animosity, but he also, you know, sort of sullied PlayStation start. And maybe that's why he wasn't there when they launched, you know. Maybe they saw, hey, this is not the right direction. I don't know. But they did relax it to their credit. And, you know, sort of the rest is history with, Final Fantasy VII. That really just blew the doors off.
Okay. From Byreal, he says, as a huge fan of Gambare Goemon, is the rumor true of Sony squashing a working design's release of the PS2 game?
We have a almost done version of it. We're still trying to get out, believe it or not. I never give up.
Wow. Okay.
So it does exist in English, but it is not releasable. It hasn't been releasable to this point. So we're still trying to find a way to make it happen. With digital, anything's possible again. I mean, you know, we've got to go back to Konami, and we have to work it out with Sony. It could happen. I don't know. But support the Kickstarter to give us hope.
Okay. Hardy Sinky asks, which video game did you find to have the most trouble localizing, and do you still favor the Xbox?
Yeah, I absolutely love the Xbox. The number of RPGs available has kind of shifted to PSP, you know, as far as them not coming out, because it's much more there's a huge input of RPGs in Japan because the PSP is very popular in Japan, but there's not a lot of output to the West because the PSP is nowhere near as popular in the Western side of the world. So the desirable targets for me have shifted to PSP, PS3, but I still have Xbox stuff that I would love to do as well. As far as tough localization, hardest localization, probably Ray Earth. I mean, Ray Earth was just a disaster from day one. Just because having the source code missing, have chunks of – they had not even source. They had libraries that were, you know, compiled already that we didn't have source for, with chunks missing out of the libraries that we had to rebuild from binary code on the retail CDs. We had to go find those pieces of code out of the CDs that were released and plug them back into the libraries. It was a disaster.
So you were actually taking the Japanese game itself, the retail CD, and
finding bits of executable code, pulling it, you know, they were executable libraries basically, and finding them in the compiled code, pulling them out and adding them to the libraries that had chunks missing out of them. It was by far, that was definitely the worst localization experience. And then, like I said, we got through all that nonsense, got it to the point where we were ready to go, and then they changed the names on us, and they were trying to force us to change the names. And yeah, it was okay. Yeah. That was the winner by a mile.
was Exile 2 also problematic for you?
No, because Exile 2 was a little bit problematic, but it wasn't like the worst localization experience. Exile 2 was an issue of, at that point, we did not have our own in-house programming. Because a lot of localization companies, even now, U.S. companies that localize Japanese product, will still not do the development themselves. They do the localization, text, the audio, whatever. They still send it to Japan and have the original Japanese team integrate it. That's still the way a lot of them do it, even now. But for us, by the time we were on Sega Saturn, we had our own in-house development. So we were taking Japanese code, and that's why our localizations were much more sort of polished. We did a lot more to them because we could. We were doing it in-house. But with Exile 2, that was when we didn't have development in-house yet for the programming changes. And our deal with Telenet was we only had X number of turns. We could only give them code and have them put it in, get it back, test it. We could only do that a certain number of times because they wanted to limit the impact on their programmers. And so we were still tweaking monster difficulty, and we tweaked a few monsters in that last area. And we, you know, it was like a tiny amount, but it was like an exponential change in their difficulty. So we accidentally made the last level of Exile 2 ridiculously hard, and it was our last turn. We could not talk Telenet into doing another compile for us. So that's what we were stuck with. We got it back initially. We thought we'd made the game unplayable. And so we played it for weeks to be able to finish the game. And once we were sure it was possible to finish the game, we were a little better with the fact that Telenet wasn't doing a fix. But up until that point, we were like, look, you have to let us do this one more time because you can't finish the game. We really thought it was unplayable. But, you know, after playing for a couple weeks, we developed strategies and we figured out how to get around it. But it's almost anticlimactic when you get to the end boss in that game because the boss is so much easier than the level before it. You know, all you had to go through to get to him and all the ways you could have died with one hit, you finally get to the final boss, you're like, oh, he was easy. But that's totally – it's not like the wind elemental in Vi. It's a mistake in when we were tweaking monsters, trying to balance them out.
I actually just want to talk about the Tengai Makyo and Sakura Wars for a second.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
I know, John, you worked – probably saw those games a lot when you were at Hudson.
Mm-hmm.
And Victor, I think you actually said Tengai Makyo 2, is your favorite non-working designs game?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a great – that was one of those, you know – Japanese experiences that kind of blew my mind. That game just had everything. You know, the music, the quest, the bosses, the battle. It was fantastic. I have a special place in my heart for Tengai Makyo anything.
Okay. Now, that was a series that was really huge in Japan for its day, I think, and it never really came to America apart from like the Neo Geo fighting game. Do you think there's any way that series could ever make it to America or be good here? Because there's a lot of cultural differences in the games and some of the stereotypes, especially in the fourth game, which is set in America. I don't know if they'd be offensive or not, but so what's your opinion?
Oh, no,
on that?
I think they'd be great. Fourth Apocalypse is a great game. Some of it's dated. I mean, like the Cool Runnings guys from Fourth Apocalypse, I don't know if that would really resonate now because it's really a dated reference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because who remembers the Jamaican bobsled team? I'm sure most kids don't. You know, anybody under probably 30 doesn't remember them. But, you know, and so that reference is kind of, you know, dated. But Fourth Apocalypse is fantastic. It's really a great, great game. Tengai Makyo is good, too. Tengai Makyo 1 is great, too.
And there's a PSP version of Tengai Makyo 4, isn't it? The Fourth Apocalypse, right?
Yes.
And I think there was a PS2 version of Tengai Makyo 2 as well as Tengai Makyo 3. And I don't know if John can remark on that, but there was a rumor.
There's an Xbox version of Tengai Makyo 1 as well.
Oh, wow. And I don't know if John was handling this or anything, but back around, I guess, 2003, there was a rumor that I think Konami or some other company was going to release the Tengai Makyo 3 PlayStation 2 game in North America. Was there anything behind that, or was it just sort of a rumor, I guess?
No, there was something behind there. I think you're talking to the right people for this question because, you know, I mentioned earlier that it's hard to convince Japanese that there's markets for some things. And, you know, when you look at a game and licensing something out to another company, what's the risk? You know, it's all upside, wouldn't it be? But the Japanese don't think that way. They think that there's harm brought to a game or to a series if it doesn't do well. Mm. And regardless of how the publisher treats it, just pure sales. If it doesn't do well, then they have egg on their face. And I think there's apprehension in bringing something that's a little bit risque or a little bit different. And I think that's kind of what happened to Tengai Makyo. Now, that said, there's you know, now that Hudson is not the company anymore, it's really Konami, I think there's always an open door that we're constantly trying to get into and to bring these kinds of titles back. So I'm glad you have interest, and I'm glad that there's still talk about these titles because they're still on our list, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, 100%. I mean, Tengamaki 4 is amazing. Actually, any of the Tengamakis would be fine. 3 is probably the weakest of the 4, but they would all be great.
But anything to get it out, then you can prove a point, then you can start to get the other one. So,
right.
And as Victor said, everything, the reason why Kickstarter is so big is not, it's not big in our world of, oh, is it going to make or break the companies? No, it's big in that all the Japanese are watching it. This is a big deal, and it'll prove a point to them. So that's why we keep saying, spread the word. Hey, get out there, do something, make it impactful. And if you do, then other things will roll from that.
Right. You know, exactly. It's not even like, even if you're not the hugest fan of Wizardry style games or moe or anime or whatever, you know, if you help us support this, it will lead to bigger things. We had to start with what was accessible now rather than 6, 12, 18 months from now, and prove that it can be done for console, which is totally different and much more difficult than PC or iOS or whatever. But if we can make a go of it and show that console games can work as a Kickstarter, then it makes our job and other publishers' jobs too, frankly, easier to do it again with even more, you know, wanted quote-unquote stuff.
Okay, and one other series that's kind of like Tengai Makio is Sakura Wars. That comes up a lot when people talk about Japanese RPG series that are huge over there, but not too big over here. And the fifth one did come out here. But I understand that even back in the Saturn era, you were looking at getting that, Victor?
They asked me to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Hojo from Red asked me to do it because we had a mutual friend, Bob Timbello, and he was really up. We had an ongoing relationship through Hudson, and he was really up on what I had done. I did the localization for Dungeon Explorer 2, The Voices, and, you know, we kind of built from there. But he was, you know, sort of effusing about the job we were doing to Red, and so Red said, hey, you know, we had a dinner with them, and he's like, you know, would you do this for us, please? But unfortunately, that goes back to Bernie Stolar and the Saturn's demise. It was clear that, you know, the end was in sight artificially, and there would be no market for it by the time we got it out. So, I mean, that honestly is probably one of the biggest sort of regrets. I don't know. Yeah, probably it's either top three or the biggest of things I wasn't able to do, that I was just broke my heart not to be able to do it. And I was being asked by the guys, Red, come on. And I was like, oh, I love this series. I love everything about it, but you got to understand the politics of it, and there's just no market for this. Even if we did it, it would be dead on arrival. And right. So, yeah, that sucked. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible thing to have to do.
And what else would be on your list of the games that you never got to do? Like Last Armageddon, maybe? Or
no, I mean, Last Armageddon was cool, but, I mean, the Sakura Wars, Sakura Tyson kind of thing, that was like a whole different level of game that didn't work out. And it was just like, and again, I mean, I really sort of revere Red, and at that time even more revered them. Because they were really prolific. They were putting out a ton of titles. And the guy that did Sakura Tyson was kind of a rock star in Japan. I mean, he would walk around like he just had fans like fawning all over him. So it was just like – it was a big deal. Yeah, it was really a big deal to be involved with it. And to have him ask me personally to do it and to have to say no, oh, my God. That was the end of a fanboy's dream right there. It was terrible. But, I mean, nothing has really approached that level. I mean, there's been disappointments, other titles that I want to do. But my attitude with most titles is – if I want to do it, there will eventually be a way to do it. Maybe not on that platform, but somewhere in the future. So I just kind of like, okay, we'll put that one aside, but we'll get back to it. And, you know, that may or may not happen. But in my mind, any title I want to do is eventually possible. I just have to find a way to get to it.
And if the Class of Heroes 2 Kickstarter takes off, are there any particular titles you really want to do compared? I know you can't really say too specific.
I don't want to speculate because I don't want to keep people's hopes up. But what I've said in other interviews, and I'll say it here too, is the list of wants of PSP titles, RPGs, and strategy RPGs, etc., that fans want, and our list are almost identical. And some of them we're already talking to publishers. Some have publishers that are waiting on the fence to see how we do with this. Yeah, I mean, it's just back to the bigger and better projects after this. We just need to get the awareness out so that we can get it funded.
Okay, well, that's about all the questions I had, Zach.
Okay.
I guess my only other question would be, we're not going to see a punching puppet for Class of Heroes, but the inflatable sword thing?
Yeah.
Is there any particular promotional goodie that you really want to see for Class of Heroes 2? Because I understand on the Kickstarter, you have a list that people can vote on.
Well, the thing that I'm most excited to about is probably the thing that people who haven't seen it would be least interested in, but the box. I mean, the box is going to really be something special. and the way the disc is presented in the box will be something special. I can't really go into too much more detail, but I mean, the package, the actual physical package itself is the thing I'm most excited about, because it's something nobody's done, and it'll be done in a totally different way that I think people, it'll blow people's minds. But we got to get it funded so I can show them. But yeah, the inflatable sword was a riff on the inflatable swords we gave out at E3 for Gralinzer. Did you ever get one of those?
No, I did not.
Yeah, they're
I did get a punching puppet, but not a.
Yeah, the swords are about. They weren't given away as like a pre-order premium. They were just given away at E3, and they were like about a 36-inch inflatable sword with like a heavy-duty vinyl, and it was awesome because people were walking around with swords in their backpacks. So luckily, everybody was like a Ronin samurai, you know, going around the E3. They were all over the place. It was really cool, but it's a cool premium because it doesn't take up a ton of space. But once it's inflated, it's really cool. So. Yeah, that's why I really want to do that. That's one
did
of the packs that really
inflated, or did you give them out non-inflated?
No, we had a compressor in one of the rooms. E3 is so loud that we had a compressor running through the whole show, and you couldn't even hear it running. somebody in one of the back, because the way our booth was set up, we had four offices, and then in between the two offices on each side, there was a storage room. And we had somebody in the storage room taking turns with a compressor just blowing up swords nonstop.
Oh, that sounds great.
So but it was so loud. It was so loud. When nobody was in the place we were setting up, we're like, oh my God, that's so loud. That's never going to work. Once the show started, it's so loud in that show, you couldn't even hear it was on.
Dude, funny.
Wow. Okay, I think Zach's going to kill me if I drag this out anymore. So,
No, it's all good. It's all good. But we do got to wrap up. So people can find you. Where can they find your site, your Kickstarter? Where can they go?
So Kickstarter, if you go to Kickstarter's homepage, and you'll find it in the video game categories. It's pretty easy. You can also get information at the www.monkeypawgames.com and also gaijinworks.com.
Right, and both the Gaijin Works and the Monkey Paw Games have a link on there that says Kickstart Us. You can click that Kickstart Us. It'll take you straight to the Kickstarter page.
Okay. All right. Well, best of luck to both of you, and thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. It was really, really, really informative.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks. Anytime. Right.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Todd, Victor, and John for joining us. The theme song is Bucharest by the band The New Division. You can find it at thenewdivision.net. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes, leave us a little rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.